know, potentially the next sort of asbestos, that we really need to be limiting our exposure. And not only does plastic not break down, it contains hundreds of chemicals on it that aren't good for us at all.
Welcome to Brave New Girl Podcast. I'm Lou Hamilton and I'm an artist, author and founder of the podcast guesting agency Brave New Girl Media. If you're interested in the health and well-being of people and the planet, then you're in the right place. My guests are change makers, focused on doing their bit towards the greater good and showing us that even taking small actions in the right direction, we can have a big impact on the world we live in. So, all aboard the mothership. Let's do this together. My guest this week is Natalie Fay, an award-winning environmentalist, author of How to Save the World for Free and Do Good, Get Paid, speaker and founder of City to Sea, a UK-based organisation running high-impact campaigns to stop plastic pollution at source, for which she won the Sunday Times Volvo Visionaries Award and the Sheila McKechnie Award for Environmental Justice. Welcome, Natalie, to Brave New Girl Podcast.
I'm very well this morning, thank you.
I'm excited to talk to you as an environmentalist and a multi-talented person. We're going to talk about the different things that you have achieved in your career and what you're doing now. And so at the moment, I'm thinking about how hard it is to do the right thing and how expensive it is to make the right choices. Like, you've got fast, cheap fashion versus more expensive, sustainable fashion. You've got fast, cheap food versus more expensive, organic fruit and veg. And so people are kind of up against it and knowing that they wanting to make the right choices, knowing they should make the right choices, but having one eye on their pocket as well. So you've brought out this book, How to Save the World for Free. So, and another one, Do Good, Get Paid. So can you tell us a bit about those?
I was inspired to write How to Save the World for Free back in 2019, I think. Well, actually, that was when it was published. So I probably started writing it in 2018. And I'd been running my organisation, which is focused on plastic pollution. I'd been running that for, at that point, probably for 5 years or so. And I felt like in 2018, it was the year that a WWF report came out and said that just in my lifetime, we'd lost half the world's wildlife. So I was 40 in 2018. And for that report to come out that in the last 40 years, we'd lost half the world's wildlife was such a shock to me. It was a similar shock to when I sort of what happened when I set up City to Sea. But I felt like that was the moment for me then when I thought, well, maybe I can take this sort of army of plastic campaigners and talk to them about the wider environmental issues that are going on with our world. And I love writing, so it felt like the right time to write a book, but that was also, you know, address the fact that those changes can be more expensive. So throughout the course of How to Save the World for Free, I, in fact, somebody described it as all the ways you can look after the planet from how you bank to how you bonk, which I thought was quite a good description. But yeah, how we can do it affordably and we can do it on a budget. But obviously there are some things that you might need to invest in which do cost more. Like, for example, if you want to get a reusable menstrual cup, you might be looking at sort of £15-20. But then over the course of the next 6 months, you'll have saved that. And then you can continue using the cup for another like 8 years. So it is, it's the sort of cost saving in the long run. So yeah, I think it is generally a balance, but I personally, it's something that I do every day. So I think I was in a position to be able to share some of my learnings and tips and tricks along the way of how to be sustainable on a budget. And then it's quite often about buying less and buying better quality, and certainly buying secondhand. So, you know, that for me was sort of some of the things around fashion and purchasing choices. And then my third book, Do Good, Get Paid, which has come out recently, was very much about a culmination of my 9 years running City to Sea and And I just got asked a lot, like, how did you do it? How do you get funding? How did you pay yourself? How do you set up a charity? How come you didn't choose a social enterprise, or all of that stuff? And I couldn't answer everybody, you know, I didn't have enough time to answer everybody. So I thought, oh, okay, that's probably then what I'm being called to write about next. So that was what inspired me to write Do Good, Get Paid.
That's interesting, because one book is more for people to consume better, and the other one is for people to do better in the sense of actually wanting to set up organizations or be more proactive in work and make that happen in a more proactive way. Would you say that was a fair assessment?
So yeah, I think they do lead on from each other, really, because if some people reading How to Save the World for Free might be inspired to then go on and do more in their day job, or they might be inspired to become campaigners around forests or rivers or oceans or soil. And there's a chapter towards the end of How to Save the World for Free called Maximizing Your Impact. And really, I think for those people who are feeling like, actually, I don't want this to just be something I do with my buying choices, I want it to be something that I do with my work, then Do Good, Get Paid sort of lays out the steps of how you might do that, or how you might get a job for an organization that are doing that, and move your day job towards a more purposeful, meaningful way of working.
So people who are coming to buy either of those books would already, I imagine, be sort of halfway there, or at least very curious. And there are those people who are wanting to make change, to be change makers, but there are then those who know that they're not maybe doing everything they could be doing, and it's quite a big mindset shift to get to the point where they go, okay, I know that I'm going to have to make sacrifices, I'm going to have to change the way I do things, I'm going to have to think in a different way. So how do you help people across that bridge?
Well, I try to do it in a really friendly, non-judgmental, sort of like inspirational way. Like, what can you do that feels good for you? What's like enough of a stretch that it feels like an achievement when you've done it, but it's not so much of a stretch that you get overwhelmed by all the things that, you know, for example, all the things that are going wrong in the world that you might be having an impact on just through existing in the systems that we exist in. Or through with Do Good, Get Paid, it may be just more about starting to have a practice where you're tuning in more to your needs and your talents and what you're really good at. And so I think wherever people are on their journey, I've had feedback from lots of lovely readers saying that it's, you know, even seasoned environmentalists have found the book really helpful. And, you know, Do Good, Get Paid being more of a career book is actually relevant for people, whether they're just leaving college or university, or they're, you know, in their 40s or 50s and they're looking to do something different because they've, you know, got that sense that they want to give more or apply their talents to something that has more of an impact in the world.
And so what about, say, people listening who just feel so terrified about the whole thing that they just either feel completely apathetic or feel like, that what's the point and it's too scary, so I'm just going to bury my head in the sand. How do you help those people?
Just from taking action, I think no matter how big or small, does help with that. And so for me, working with my day job or the charity that I set up, knowing that we were stopping hundreds of tons of plastic every year, just felt like, well, I'm doing something, and my team feel like they're doing something, and they have meaningful work. So for me, I was fortunate that I have that feeling. But obviously there are times when I hear another report or I read something and I think, gosh, you know, what's the point? But actually there's this wonderful quote by the author Clarissa Pinkola Estes, and she wrote the seminal book Women Who Run With Wolves, and there's this fantastic quote about environmentalism and also the sort of social challenges that we face in the world. And she says, ours is not the task of fixing the entire world at once, ours is the task of mending the part of the world that's within our reach. And I really love that. And I've moved to a small town near Bristol on the coast recently, and it's quite interesting noticing my interest in the local environment. So, for example, we, you know, sewage, you know, obviously I've been working a lot with plastic, but now because I'm swimming in the sea, I'm more tuned into sewage pollution. This weekend I went down a bit of a rabbit hole because I heard that there was a lot of radioactive sludge from a nearby nuclear power station dumped over at Cardiff Bay and dumped just up the road at Portishead as little as like last year. And so I'm like, well, hang on, if we're swimming in that every day, what's the impact of that? So it's like a local, like, you know, and would I then, oh, and the other thing was the swifts. Like, I noticed here that in summer there were swifts here, and I hadn't noticed swifts in Bristol. I don't think we get swifts in Bristol. And there was only about six pairs, maybe not even that, maybe like four pairs of them flying around this spring and summer. And it was the most amazing thing. And I was like, well, I want to know more. Why are there so few? But how can I help and get a swift box? So it's like looking at those local things, I think, that we can do in our local environment that can help people feel, A, connected to other people that are making a difference, and B, just connected to our local environment. And I think, you know, some people are fantastic at those big global systemic political changes. And I think if you or anyone listening is that kind of academic, debating kind of person, you know, there are some amazing organizations out there like Client Earth, who do incredible things in terms of challenging legislation, and that, you know, is really helpful. But then even at City to Sea, we do some great legislation work and around getting the laws changed around plastic. So signing petitions is still a powerful thing.
I want to go deeper into City to Sea, but first, can we get a context of who you are and how you got onto this journey in the first place? So looking back to the little girl that you were, are there any clues when you look back at her to the woman you've become?
Great question. Yeah, I think it's interesting. So I recently changed my surname from Fee to Faye, and I added an accent over the E because I've always loved it. Whenever I went to France or Germany, or I think the Netherlands, they'd say, "Oh, your surname means woodland fairy," and I'd be like, "Yes, I know, I'm a woodland fairy at heart." And then about two years ago now, I decided, like, do you know, I'm just going to add the accent and call myself Natalie Fay because I feel more aligned with a woodland fairy than I do with a financial transaction, which is what fee obviously means for people. Originally, it was an old Irish word that meant the raven from Ó Féach when we trace our heritage back. I should have maybe just changed it back to that, but I like Fay. So I think as a child, I was very into nature. I wasn't like into identifying or cataloguing or that sort of thing, but being in the garden. We grew up in a sort of quite a suburban area, but there were still quite a lot of trees and bushes around and gardens. And so that was my happy place, really. So, you know, and I used to leave little offerings at the bottom, the tree trunks for the fairy people, you know. And and actually when I see my life now, so not so much the sort of, you know, the campaigning and the TV and media stuff that I've done, but what's drawing me towards it now is around that sort of spiritual practice and that connecting with the more than seen worlds. So that, and I used to love being on camera. I was always like, take my photo here, let me do a play here, let me sing a song. So I was always performing and I always wanted an audience. It's probably why I imagined and liked the unseen world, because then I always had an audience.
And so when you left home, where did that part of you lead you to?
Well, I was sort of shoehorned down the well, actually, I left home before going to university, just because I felt like I was ready. Well, I went to university, lasted about 6 weeks because I didn't feel ready to go. But my parents were concerned because I was a bit of a wild child that if I didn't go to university, I'd go massively off the rails. So they said I had to go. And I went and just after 6 weeks realised it wasn't for me. And within a few months of returning home and getting temporary office jobs, and I got a job in recruitment, and I think I was probably still only 19. And the next 3 years were like this super fast track, end of the 90s IT recruitment haze of hard work and earning a lot of money back then. And so I think I have a taste of sales and being able to make a living. And, you know, I was earning more than both of my parents combined by the time I was 21 and had a house. But I had this very sort of spiritual aspect to myself as well. And I'd started practicing yoga around that time when I was about 19, 20. And at the time, I didn't know how the two could marry. They felt like they were sort of opposites, this corporate me that was commuting and earning lots of money and smoking and other things. And then this sort of spiritual me that was really interested in religions of the world and meditation, and I felt like they weren't compatible. So I gave up the day job and went off to pursue I went off traveling, and I went to South America and lived with a shaman for a while. And this is going back like 20 something years ago. And then, you know, gradually over the years found my way back to business, and realized that the two, having a spiritual practice and a spiritual life, isn't incompatible with doing business or even being in, you know, corporate environments.
And then you had a bit of a stop you moment when you said you watched the trailer for the film Albatross, and that kind of shocked you into shifting how you thought about the world and your position in it.
Yeah, it was very much a wake up moment. I was working in TV at the time, and I saw this video of these incredible albatross chicks dying in their nest with their bellies full of plastic, and it was absolutely heartbreaking. Like, I'd seen firsthand in South America, like deforestation and all sorts of things that were impacting our environment, but seeing these everyday items of plastic that I was using inside the bellies of these incredible creatures was just sort of too much to bear, and it really sort of broke me open. And I think, in a good way, I think it was important to feel the pain of the consequences of our actions. And that was really what motivated me to start doing something about plastic pollution. But I didn't really know where to begin. And actually, as I do write music from time to time, and I'd written a song around then, which I thought could work to a video about plastic pollution. So that was my first step, really, was like more of an artistic response to plastic pollution, doing this crowdfunder which raised money for a music video and producing the music video. So yeah, and then I realized that after, you know, a few months that had been released and only a few thousand people had watched it, because as I say in my book, newsflash, I'm not Adele and I don't have like millions of followers waiting for my next single to drop yet. and then that's when I then started City to See, because I thought, hang on, I've got all this momentum and maybe there's more that I can do.
So you've written a whole book about starting an organization. So can you give us a bit of a lowdown on how you went from thinking starting an organization might be good to actually making it happen and having an impact?
I had a day job, so I was still working in telly. So it started off as something I was doing in my spare time. And I first of all did research. I asked, well, who's already doing it? Is anyone? I knew there was a few organisations around the UK, maybe just two at the time, that were involved in beach cleans. There was no jobs going with either of those. That's what my first step was. And then when I looked, well, who's tackling plastic pollution sort of upstream? Who's stopping it from getting there in the first place? And there didn't seem to be anyone in that area. So then I thought, well, let's have some consultations in Bristol and see what the public and other organisations in the space feel is needed. So I guess it was like a research phase, getting the lay of the land. And then we decided to start the refill campaign. So after having the consultations, the thing that people most cared about was plastic bottled water, because you just had bottled water, plastic bottles littered everywhere across Bristol, but also washing up on the riverbanks and the sea near us. And the other thing was cotton bud sticks that people would use to clean their ears out or use for makeup and flush them down the toilet, which they shouldn't have done. But it meant that millions of them were ending up on our beaches around the UK and around the world. So those were the two that we decided to focus on, the first being the refill campaign, which was just about putting up stickers on windows of shops saying, come in for a free refill. And then we turned that into an app. And we got about £15,000 of funding from a Bristol initiative, which was about us being European Green Capital in 2015. So I had two people working as consultants. I was still full time in my day job, and it kind of grew from there. And then with the cotton bud campaign, I had a lot of advisors and helpers and people that would tell me what I might need to do to run a campaign. And then I think because of my business experience, I managed to get into a meeting of the water companies and ask them to fund the campaign to get cotton buds banned, because that would have saved them millions if they didn't have all these plastic sticks being flushed into the systems and overburdening the sewers. And so they gave us about £15,000. And at that point, I started paying myself and one other person. There was still someone else working on refill, and we started working on Switch the Stick for 2 days a week. And that was a huge success. We managed to get them banned. It was just insane and fast paced, and we were growing quite quickly. And then we started applying for funding and creating corporate partnerships. And so then we had a different sort of, I built up as many different income streams as I could. Definitely made a load of mistakes along the way, which I talk about in the book, because I'd never run a campaigning organization before. Really run my own business before. I had a short term when I was in my 20s running my own recruitment company, but you know, this was different. So that's hopefully what I've encapsulated, or at least shared the highs and the lows.
So with plastic pollution, I mean, it kind of, it makes sense, you know, people who are on the beach having a picnic and don't put their rubbish into the nearest bin. But the stuff that's in the ocean isn't just from that. There's tons and tons and tons, billions of tons of plastic pollution. Where does that all come from? So if we're kind of happily flushing away or throwing away or recycling, something happens from our use to it being in the sea, and we're kind of blind to it. So can you paint a picture of what happens between those two things?
Yes, I can. So we've got between 8 and 12 million tons of plastic sort of leaking into our oceans every year. And most of that is coming from land-based sources. So around 1 million tons a year is sort of leaked at sea. So that might be where a container full of plastic things or full of plastic nurdles, the little beads that are used in plastic production to make bigger pieces of plastic, there might be a spill at sea. And fishing litter. So the fishing industry often discard a lot of nets that are made of plastic. So that's known as ghost gear, because it floats around in the ocean and it still keeps fishing and entangling marine animals in it. So you have around 1 million of that sort of 8 to 12 million that's happens at sea. The rest is coming into land. Now, about another million is tiny, tiny microplastics. So that's the stuff that comes out of our synthetic clothes when we wash them and goes into our sewers and then gets out into the sea. So the microfibers are the third biggest source of microplastic pollution. Then you've got the pellets, the nurdles that I said, that still leak even from land, from plastic production sites that are near water. And tyre dust, which is a really interesting one in terms of the microplastics. The number one source of microplastics in the ocean is from our car tyres and truck tyres made of plastic wearing down, and the rains come and wash that, and that obviously goes into rivers and goes out into our seas. So that's sort of, so we're looking at 1 million from the fishing industry, about 1 million tonnes from our wastewater and the microplastics. And then the rest of it is leaking from rivers around the world, and about 10 rivers around the world are the most highly centric, sort of plastic centric sources of that. But there's also our toilets. So for example, here in the UK, our sewage system, unfortunately, is still badly designed in that when it's overburdened, they open up these sewage overflows, and things like period plastics or wet wipes that are all made of plastic also flush out into our rivers and seas. So that being the thing for us all to do whilst we're waiting and putting pressure on the water companies to not do that is for us to not flush anything other than pee paper and poo down the loo. But just circling back to those big volumes, so you know, the remaining 8 million or whatever tons that are going into the seas every year, our recycling, we're exporting around 60% of our recycling here in the UK. So we gather it up. Some of it goes to be incinerated, sadly, and feed these new waste to energy plants. And some of it gets exported. And once it's exported, it's a lot of the companies sort of sign the box, say, yes, we've recycled our plastic, but then it's once it's exported, it's quite hard to trace of where it actually goes. Organisations like Greenpeace have been very good at tracking some of this waste. And there was a show with Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall and Anita Rani, which highlighted our plastic ending up in open landfills in countries that have taken our plastic off us, but that don't have the facilities to recycle it. Those open landfills either then get burnt, so just incinerated, or they can also leak into the ocean. So we shouldn't sort of point our finger at these 10 rivers around the world and say, well, look, that's where all the rubbish is coming from, because actually, if you look, some of our rubbish does end up in those too. But, you know, there are some brilliant organisations that and innovation that's coming that are helping those countries process their plastic waste better, whilst also trying to get those big multinational companies to use less plastic in the first place.
So as well as watching what we flush down the loo, what else? We're kind of just starting out on this and we're kind of faced with this hugely overwhelming problem. How do we start? What are the first few steps that we can make that would have the kind of biggest impact?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I do think that, so there are the things that you can do every day. So, you know, when you're out and about, just the basics, like carry a reusable water bottle, a reusable coffee cup, and, you know, some cutlery in your bag, sort of the light things. You might need a bigger bag. If you've got a car, just keeping your reusable coffee cup and a pack of reusable cutlery sort of in your glove box, that sort of thing, just so that you're prepared for those on-the-go moments when you might get caught out. Then if you want to sort of de-plastify your home a bit more, because it's not just the fact that plastic's polluting, it's also harmful to our health. So there's a lot more studies coming out now that we're inhaling microfibers from synthetic carpets, curtains, toys, and that what we're inhaling actually doesn't break down in our lungs. And so there's a lot of quite worrying studies out there saying that this is, you know, potentially the next sort of asbestos, that we really need to be limiting our exposure. And not only does plastic not break down, it contains hundreds of chemicals on it that aren't good for us at all. So limiting how our food is stored. So what you might want to do is, for your freezer sections, for example, is invest in some good quality Pyrex dishes with lids that you can freeze, so that you're not freezing your things in plastic. So there's the sort of the health element of looking to minimize your plastic exposure. And then if you want to sort of have that great feeling of having less plastic in your bin, then generally the bathroom is a great place to start. Like, do you need that shower gel, or could it be a nice bar soap with your disposable razor? Could you switch to a reusable one? I think they're called them safety razors, although they're not that safe. You do have to be careful not to cut yourself. Shampoos and conditioners, can you get refills from your local zero waste shop? So I think the sort of the bathroom, if you have periods, could you switch to reusable period products? Like the bathroom is quite an easy space to begin with making those changes, affordable changes. The kitchen's much harder because, as we know, here in the UK, we have the second highest plastic usage per capita in the world, and it's hard to avoid it when you're out shopping. So I think choosing loose whenever you can, and shopping local, shopping at markets, those are ways that you can use less plastic. But if you're busy, you've got kids, you've got a day job, you haven't got the time to go to three different zero waste shops and a veg shop, you know, I understand. and I think that's where the power of supporting organisations like City to See, and that could be a financial donation, or that could literally be just signing up to the newsletters and sharing petitions, signing and sharing petitions, is a very quick thing that you can do that means you're playing your part, but it's recognising that you might not have the resources to live this fabulously plastic-free life.
And you've mentioned that you do have a spiritual practice that supports you through this. So if you were thinking about your vision for the future and coming from a spiritual place, what would that look like?
Need some thinking about, because that's a beautiful question. It comes back to stillness and cultivating an awareness of who we really are beyond the noise and the pressures and the worries and all of the sort of things that distract us on a daily basis. I think coming to an awareness of who we really are and discovering that stillness and that light in a way within us, I think is a very healing thing to do. And I think the more healed we are, I think the kinder we become. And as we become and sort of strive for less in a way, it's sort of we're not looking out there to fulfill us, because we're fulfilled through ourselves and through our relationship to the inner world. But that also, what I'm experiencing, I just talk from my own experience, is that the deeper I go with my journey into becoming more aware of who I am, I'm also more sensitive to nature and developing more of a conscious relationship with nature that's not just tree that does acorns that I can, you know, sit under. It's actually more tree that has a consciousness that I can be in relationship with, that can guide me and inspire me, and I can also heal it as well. So there's a two-way flow going on. So I guess that's a long way of saying my vision for the future would be where that's not something that is brushed aside into the woo-woo category, or is sort of like, oh well, that's a hippie thing, but is actually acknowledged and cultivated, I guess, a little like in our original people traditions around the world, which here in the UK we've lost a lot of our ancient sort of Celtic traditions, or the people that were here even before them, which was much more land-based. So I would say vision for the future would be to connect more to our hearts and the spirit of the land.
And how do you define courage in the light of that?
It's a good one for me, because I have definitely struggled in my life with a lot of fear. So that's been one of the things that I've tried to work through. I should probably read your book or books. And so that's, yeah, been something for me, scared of what people think, or scared something bad's going to happen. Living with that sense of fear has meant that I've had to cultivate courage, and it doesn't go away. Like there are still days when I'm scared of saying something that might, you know, in our social culture, like might get cancelled. Or so I think courage is, yeah, acknowledging those edges, those shadows within yourself, and then taking the time to transform them with love and sometimes a stick and sometimes a blanket.
I love that. I've just started meditating, and I too am on a long journey to try and be more courageous. Thank you so much, Natalie, for campaigning for the environment in ways that we can all participate in. It's been an amazing conversation, and I love how you're approaching it, and I love that you're balancing the spiritual and the practical. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Lou. And I'm definitely going to order your books now as well, seeing as we've talked about overcoming fears. And yeah, thanks so much for having me and giving my work and City to Sea's work a platform in the world.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much, Natalie, for showing us that when we look at what we use in everyday life, we can make good choices that help rather than harm the planet. You can find out more about her work at www.nataliefay.com and follow her on Instagram at nataliefay_. Thank you, Brave New Girl Media, for producing and sourcing the guests for the show, and to you for listening. I hope today's story inspires you to step into the spotlight and show how you too are positively impacting the world. Take care, choose courage, and see you next time.